Welcome to Rooster Radio, where we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. I'm Andrew Montesi. It has been quite some time since our last episode. We took a break from Rooster HQ to focus on our real businesses. But now we're back with our South Start series, which we're pretty excited about. We're interviewing some of the stars of the South Start Conference, which celebrates the collision of people, ideas and technology in Adelaide on November 21 to 23. And first cab off the rank is the man behind South Start in 2018, Craig Swan. South Start fell into the hands of Craig and his business partners last year, and he's done an amazing job pulling together a world-class event and activating an interesting startup community in Adelaide. Craig is a highly successful global innovator in his own right. The Canadian founded companies in New York City, including award-winning interactive agency Crash Media, and the internet's first online music studio, Loop Labs. Millions of people have benefited from Craig's innovations, including Steve Jobs, who demoed Loop Labs for the launch of the Safari browser at an Apple keynote. Craig has since become an industry thought leader in the interactive music space, authoring books, speaking internationally, teaching, curating tech events, and developing and licensing customized online music experiences for top global brands. He's received special recognition at South by Southwest and has won the prestigious Webby Award. Before we get into Craig's fascinating story, make sure you open your browser right now and check out southstart.co. South Start is activating Adelaide's startup community by bringing together innovators, creators, founders and investors from November 21 to 23 in 2018. Get involved, grab a ticket and we'll see you there. If you're late to this interview and have realised you've missed the event, make sure you sign up to the mailing list and follow South Start on social media and join the community. All right, let's jump into the interview with Craig Swan. Craig, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Well, Rooster Radio's back. It's been a while, but I think it's time to fire things up again. I've got rid of Beggs. He was a dead weight. And now I'm just going to make it all about me. And then secondly, my guests. So, Craig, stoked to have you in here, mate. We've had a number of coffees over the last year as you've attempted to do some things and build some things in Adelaide's interesting startup ecosystem. But before we get into all of that, I want to wind the clock right back and I want you to describe yourself as a child. What were you like?
As a child? I was small. That's probably the first thing that comes to mind. I mean, beyond maybe how I was as a person, you know, being inquisitive. I mean, I remember, for instance, the day that, this is actually profound, really. I mean, the day that Elvis died was the day before my birthday. I was 5 years old. And that night, and just recently my mom reminded me, she goes, you know, that night you said to me, like, you're going to change the world with music. And like, looking back now, it's insane. Like, I barely could have even comprehend music. Though my mom still will always remind me once in a while, like, it's crazy. Like, you said that to me as a 5-year-old. I was like,
where did she get that from?
I have no idea. I mean, I think partly it might have been the fact that, and I can't, it's just so hard to dig up kind of memories from that time. I mean, I certainly remember seeing it in the paper, in the checkout line when it happened. I think part of it was just to see such the amount of like, the effect it had on people. Like, He was an icon. Mm. He was a legend. And when he passed, I guess perhaps as a child, I saw just the impact that one person could have through music to affect so many people that maybe part of me wanted to somehow be a part of that energy because it was so persuasive. But I don't really know. But certainly I think one of the things that when I do look back and think about what things shaped me was the fact that my stature, it took me a long time to grow up. I was always the smallest kid in the class, in the school. And with that, I mean, I grew up during like the 80s, you know, WWF. So I was a kid that was like, all right, let's try the pile driver. Like, let's do the body slam. I was the easiest kid to pick up and toss around. So I think certainly there was a sense of resilience that came from that. But out of that, you know, one of the things now that I'm thinking back about that time, I'll never forget, you know, I had this, gym teacher, Mr. McPherson. And he was totally like, Magnum P.I. had the mustache, this big guy, just totally just from that era. And we would do like dodgeball, which probably was called murder ball. And I was small, but I was fast. So I could always like outrun people getting dodged, and he would like get me amped up. He'd be like, "Swanee, come on!" Like, you know, and like I got my knees are bleeding, and I'm diving, and he's trying to like just kill me. But I would like, he just loved like, cause I could do it, right?
Yeah.
But the same guy, when we were doing high jump, we were jumping and doing high jump in gym class, and the bar kept going up and up, and people started falling, and all of a sudden the high jump bar got where it was over my head, and I was still in it, and that's when he came up to me and goes, "All right, man, you're done. Swanee, you're out." And I was just so perplexed. Like, I was about to jump more than my height. And that's not easy to do. And I thought a lot about that later in life, you know, thinking that really what I think he was doing was I was the sacrifice for his other jock guys that were on the teams. I can't make my tall, strong guys, like, fall before the smallest kid in the class. I mean, maybe it's a good thing. If he kept me going, I might have been a high jumper and never been here. So a lot of those experiences, which those are all kind of physical ones, certainly played a role into my development. But at the same time, in that early 80s was when computers came out. So I had a computer, you know, the VIC-20 was the first computer I had. I was about 8 or 9. And a year later, I got the Commodore 64. And I was running BBS in my room. And I think definitely that was probably, I don't know if it was an escape, but certainly there was a fascination with being able to connect with other people through this computer. And probably was a bit of an outlet for me to not have to go and get beat on.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I was beat on, but certainly I would get maybe sat on a lot. but that's where I fell in love with computers, and, you know, as a young child. And I often joke about, you know, there's very few people that kind of found computers at the same time as pubic hair, right? And it's a special generation. Like, there's a special time where only one generation will have found technology, because it only happens sort of once in your life. So I had that appreciation of as a young child that explored and did a lot of things people here in South Australia do, riding bikes, playing in the parks, just being out there. But then growing up with technology. So now I'm a little long-winded, not sure where I'm going, but...
No, this is good, mate.
It's interesting, some of the things I'm thinking about. But certainly found myself isolated in a way where I chose to lock myself into this online world. I was a 10-year-old calling myself Rum Runner, running a BBS. And my mom found out, she's like, "Jesus Christ, who are you talking to? Are you talking like some truckers online and like, you know, you're doing wares as a 10-year-old and you don't even know what rum is and you're calling yourself Rum Runner?" Like, it was, you know, I had like the anarchist cookbook, like all this crazy stuff, because that was just what you did back then. But I think looking back, a lot of that shapes my love for community and the ability for technology to connect people. I think that's just one of the most amazing things about it.
So tech was a massive influence early on. What else was influencing you and shaping you, whether it's things or people?
Yeah, I mean, I think sports. I was very adept at sports. So a lot of times, you know, I make all-stars on hockey or in basketball, these sports. As the smallest kid, I was goalie in soccer. Like, you think the smallest kid. But I just never cared enough. And I think that probably frustrated maybe my dad a little bit. Like, he would see the potential and go, "But you're just like, you're not like, you could be like really good." But I was like, "Ugh, I just don't even want to bother like practicing or doing that."
Yeah.
So I was lucky that a lot of those things came easy to me. But I think it was computers and it was music. I mean, 1983, was one of the most amazing years ever for music and technology. It was really the year that the CD-ROM properly came out. That's when you got Blue Monday, the biggest single ever, came out. You got Thriller came out, the biggest album of all time, although the Eagles just eclipsed it. The Commodore 64 came out. It's the biggest selling computer of all time. You had sort of ARPANET and TCP/IP actually became a real thing. So the birth of the internet, you could largely argue, sort of happened at that time. And that was right when I was in the thick of it. And right around that time, as I was sort of, you know, definitely into sort of computers as a new thing, I'll never forget, you know, hearing, you know, the crazy sounds of Jimi Hendrix's Star Spangled Banner, from across a neighbor's thing. And it's just the sounds just blew my mind. I didn't even know what it was. And that got me super fascinated with the fact that a human being could actually make those sounds with a guitar. So then I started playing guitar, and then I fell in love with that whole process and kind of weaned myself a little bit off the computers and then started to fall in love with music. I think that's probably where the underpinnings of, you know, how those things have weaved through a lot of my life have come from, probably those definitive moments.
At the time, what are you thinking about what you want to do with your life at that point?
What is it, 10 or 12 year old?
Yeah, like, well, like, what were your aspirations?
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. You know, there's a show called Family Ties, Alex B. Keaton. And for whatever reason, I was fascinated with the idea of like, yeah, I'm going to be a millionaire. I'm just going to be this, like, this guy just makes a lot of money and something about that. So I had this, not even knowing what $1 million was or what it was, I had this fascination with wanting to make it and be an entrepreneur. So I think that, and like, I remember, like, I found a way to save up enough money to buy a VCR, back in the days and record shows. And, but I would charge my sister to record her favorite soap opera that was on television during the day when she was at school. And she still bugged me about that. Like, Jesus Christ. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was probably expensive, like a buck a show or something. Like, she was younger than me. So there's definitely, I guess, an entrepreneurial sort of leaning in all that. I think I had to do a lot of things on my own as a result of being sort of a smaller person, had to kind of fend for themselves. You learn to get pretty good at looking out for yourself. So I think that probably played a significant part in the meshing of music, being, again, an experience that you can have by yourself. There's so much growth involved with music, computers, being able to connect with other people. And I guess that sense of, as a young person, entrepreneurship or fascination with being able to create something out of nothing or all kind of, yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't really thought about those being kind of like the legs on a stool of what I'm sitting on right now, but I think that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, perhaps, maybe fast forwarding a little bit, but how did all of this kind of culminate and evolve into the beginnings of Crash Media?
So, I mean, falling in love with the web. So, I mean, I was in university in the early 90s and had access to the web via the university when it first came out in 91. And I'd certainly been BBSing and was familiar with that, but this was just, it was different. Like, the web was different. The ability to do more sophisticated things and connect with people on a different level, a larger scale, fascinated with me. But it was around that same time that, you know, I was also very interested in music, obviously. I was in my own band. I was a deadhead, and I was very much into the culture that was around that, which was social music. People taped shows. They shared it. It was very free. It was very free, very open community of people that, and entrepreneurial. People would be in the parking lot selling things and finding a way to get to the next show. Mm. And I got caught up with that because it was just amazing. Never mind the music and the experience. And I guess, you know, I had my own little epiphany in a parking lot drum circle, feeling really good, thinking, how do you bottle up this sort of idea of people making music together and sharing this amazing feeling? Anyone who's played music with multiple people, like, it's a profound, you know, awesome experience I want as many people to have. But then this web thing is here. I'm like, what would those things look like? So I wanted to pursue that, and that sort of set me on the path. But, you know, dropping out of university as a result of that, realizing the internet's not available unless you're in university, I'm like, oh, what am I going to do now? Mm. Got me into desktop publishing, digital music production, sort of in the sort of early mid-90s. Then the web came around in 94, and was basically, you got it. And I remember I didn't leave literally for like 6 months. I didn't leave my parents' basement. Like, almost, like, it was a dark spot for my family. You know, what's going on with this guy? Cause you go down the rabbit hole where it's just like, oh my God, like, everything is there. Mm. And I can create things. I can express things. I can connect with people. And back then you learned. There was no place to learn this stuff. You had to kind of just view source or pull it apart and build from scratch. So that kind of got me, you know, building websites and doing things. And
it's a hard thing to explain to family members as well who wouldn't understand what's actually happening.
Oh, dude, I was, yeah, and just the communities. I was very lucky. There was a community called V-Rave, which is like an old Telnet sort of chat community. And it was very much around the rave culture and community, but a lot of people that were based in San Francisco. So you had a lot of people that were in university there, like, doing crazy stuff, super smart, but also, you know, partying hard. So you meet a lot of interesting people, a lot of ideas you're getting exposed to that you wouldn't normally get exposed to. I mean, it was a very nascent internet culture, right? But as a result of that, I was obviously kind of on more the leading edge of people in Toronto, started actively doing stuff, tried to go to school to learn stuff, but realized pretty soon I was, you know, helping people there because I knew as much or more than the people that were supposed to be teaching it. So I found myself in a position to start getting some interesting projects. And my agency kind of grew out of that, and having some high profile opportunities like the University of Toronto, or doing stuff for like the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, like some big hype, got me more and more attention. And then you fell into the design crew. And it's funny, I was talking recently with someone, you know, cause design is kinky, and that whole crew out in Australia here, like I was totally down with that scene, the K10K and the Prey Station, all that kind of stuff. Like I was that first wave of just like design internet kiddies, just kind of trying to break the internet. And that allows you to kind of wrap yourself into an interesting group of people, and tap into, you know, a lot of things that are happening at the time and being exposed to ideas. And it was so open source back then, man. Mm. Like, it's like, I mean, there's open source now, but it was a different mindset because like no one knew what they were doing, and everyone was like, oh, how'd you do that? And people were happy to share. Like, you know, even now when I reflect and I tell the younger people I meet now and say like, you know, it's crazy. Like the first website that had drag and drop, like I did that in like the late '90s, but that received an international design award from South by Southwest, and all of a sudden now you've got a bigger platform. Now I'm building sites that are tracking polar explorers, you know, going to the North Pole in real time with satellite phones and little iPad compact devices, and you're just kind of do all these really cool things. And it's one of the things I miss the most about what happens now, because everyone's got, you know, templated, you know, WordPress stuff, and that GeoCities sense of the internet or the early MySpace thinking of just like make it your own is kind of gone. And I feel very, I have mixed feelings about, you know, where the internet's going with regards to the true expression.
Yeah.
For sure.
I guess back then, what were some of the more, I mean, you mentioned a couple, but some of those more interesting projects, but also, you know, some of the brands or companies willing to pay for this stuff.
Like, oh yeah, there was lots of money back then.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think, everyone needed it. No one knew how to do it. And if you were, you know, this is the world of Flash, right? So Flash was something that, you know, again, a lot of younger people aren't even familiar with. Mm. Older people remember it as that annoying thing that you had to keep updating the plugin. Mm. But it was truly the first ubiquitous, like, interactive platform where you could do animation. You could do crazy, user experience things. You could do, just a lot of just, I mean, yeah, it was just crazy. And I was very fortunate to be able to be a part of the beta groups that were rolling out with Macromedia and Adobe. So playing with those technologies first. So you're the first person that gets their hand on being able to do something. So as soon as finally interactive music was even somewhat possible, I had access to it before anyone else did. And I was like, oh, that vision I had, I'm going to build that. And really, like, even Loop Labs was my first prototype of how I could build something that fulfill an idea I had. And that obviously morphed into an amazing thing where you get brands being aware of these types of things, and all of a sudden, you know, you find yourself in a whole different world where it's now being commercialized.
You mentioned Loop Labs. We'll come to that in a sec. But how are you, I always wonder, knowing a lot of creatives, there's like that desire to create, to design, to do something that isn't necessarily attached to money or a business model. As a creative, how have you worked through that? Like that kind of tension of wanting to create something cool, but also needing to get paid.
Yeah. You know, it's again, I mean, I was born at the wrong time. I feel like I'm truly a hippie at heart. And so my thoughts are probably not reflective of the normal. But I certainly have learned watching other people that I think the harder you chase money, that's the quickest way not to get it. I think if you do something you love and you pour your passion to it, like, money tends to follow that. And I've just been fortunate that that's been my experience. That I created these really interesting things that were cool to me. I just wanted to see how far I could push things. I mean, I was not a computer science trained person. I had to learn this stuff as I grew up. But I always wanted to do that extra thing. But doing that extra thing where no one else wanted to do the extra thing meant people were like, oh, this is cool. I want that. And that's why, you know, as a business sort of person, you learn, okay, well, how do you begin to license or commercialize? And that turns into a whole other thing about how you can monetize your creations. But I think it always has to start with fulfilling your own desire for what you think needs to get done or what problem you think you're solving. That has to happen first. Figuring out ways to create money, if it's doing those things, will happen. I think sometimes people get caught up too much figuring out the whole business plan and how am I going to make money off this first before they even build something that anyone cares about. So it's certainly a delicate tightrope, but
You were brought up in a culture of giving things away. as well. Mm. You know, people creating, people just giving stuff away, that community
True.
Spirit, which is, I guess, an extra piece of tension when you're trying to create a business.
Yeah, people involved. Were not conservative with regards to their ideas. And I mean, it was just, it was explosion of, it was a celebration of all these things because it was all so new that you had so many different platforms and avenues for people to want to highlight this work. I mean, I don't think you see that as much anymore. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, it really was. I mean, 20 years ago is really, it was such a different time. I think, you know, like the fact that, you know, like my company started before Google, and I tell an 18-year-old I'm talking to now, and they just go, what? Like, how could you have an internet company before Google? Wasn't Google the internet? Like, you don't know if you're not there, right?
Yeah.
And you never think about it back then, but now these things become really interesting looking in the rearview mirror. It's like, yeah, it is kind of crazy, like how things developed and when you put things in perspective.
Mm. So how was Loop Labs birthed out of all of this?
So really it was, as I mentioned, you know, the ability, as soon as it was kind of feasible to sort of wide scale create it on a platform, people could use it, experimented and built the first thing that would allow you to mix music and share it and do that kind of stuff. But being the first time it was ever done on the internet, it got picked up through a lot of these things that wanted to promote cool stuff on the web. And so, you know, I think it just escalated because the web was about finding the shiny new thing.
Yeah. So, So specifically, how did it get traction? That virality?
So I was a big part of community, certainly. So this is around 2000 when it came out. And I was a big part of that whole community. So, events, we were running big user groups in Toronto. I was going to the big sort of, internet conferences around the States. So I had a pretty good network because my friends were all like that. They would be running these sites that had that. So when I did it, I told them, they're like, oh damn, like show it to them. So kind of all the cool kids doing stuff would find it. They'd want to share it with their friends and say, look at this cool thing. You can make music. So I think it was easier to be viral, if you will, back then because there's less things vying for your attention. So that certainly helped. I think it's just lucky. I mean, it was just right place, right time. Like I had this idea for a long time. I was able to be positioned to execute it right when it was possible and be sort of the first to market with something that just got people's attention.
Well, cause organic growth is so bloody hard now. Just with the social platforms all moving towards paid everything.
Well, it's signal to noise. That's the other thing. There was, not a wasteland, but it was certainly a very different frontier back then in terms of the people that were on the internet and using any capacity. Like right now, in today's world with the advent, certainly of social media and mobile, you know, smartphones, which didn't exist back then, it's just a different world. I mean, you just got to see people doing the infinite scroll all day long and you realize that it's very easy to get sucked up in that. So at one point you've got, consumption in many ways overriding creation. But you also have, how do you get cut through that noise? I mean, the extremes that people are having to do things to get attention, sometimes it's monumental.
Mm.
And so I think a lot of people look at like, how could I ever do that? And a lot of people don't realize that the things that go viral, those are very well orchestrated things that are done with very key influencers and influencer pods and agencies. Like, you don't hear about that until years later and you think it was totally just something. But, you know, those days of, you know, Harry or, you know, biting Harry or, you know, coming out of the dentist, like those days are gone. Like, you know, so I think it's hard when I talk to people now about how they're going to grow their company, how to do that, but I would still hearken it to just make sure what you're doing actually is really, really good and it's useful to someone. If it is, they'll tell it to somebody else that would find it useful. Like that's the first place you always have to start. For sure.
So how did Loop Labs evolve from something that was this cool semi-underground thing that was picking up that early traction? How did you evolve it from, because a lot of businesses do start with that little spike and then they don't know how to take it into something more significant or more stable. Like, how did you do that?
Well, I mean, again, a lot of forces lined up where, you know, it got the attention of the Webby Awards, and so picking up an award for that gets you a lot more attention, and South by Southwest gives you awards for it. That gives you attention. And I guess that attention got into the mind of Steve Jobs. Mm. And somehow he knew this thing existed. He decided to use that as one of the internet tools to showcase when he launched the Safari browser at a keynote, which is crazy because, you know, back then it was streamed, you had ICQ and you'd just be watching this as a fanboy, certainly of Apple and what Jobs was doing at that time. you just go, holy shit, like this guy's just like pulled up Loop Labs and like my ICQ was going on fire and everyone's like, oh my God. They don't tell you this, by the way. Hey, just get ready. This is going to happen.
So now. Yeah, so you got no heads up.
No. The heads up was really just watching it and just in disbelief. Like this is what? This is crazy. Like that's certainly like that's nerd moment, right? That'll be, I don't know how many things in my life might top that for me personally, but now it becomes on a different radar. So I was very lucky to have a platform like that that got it exposed. But this was something that was done as a way to connect people with music. Very quickly, I had to learn, right, so how do I capitalize on this? Now, I did have a lot of inbound coming in, but now I had to learn about how am I going to structure licensing deals? How am I going to start positioning myself? So I knew I had something. And whenever you get in a position where you think you know something and there's a bit of leverage there, you got to be really intelligent at how you position your opportunities. Which thing, I mean, a lot of people I had to say no to, right? I mean, a lot of people want to do cheesy stuff with it. And I knew, like, that's not a good look. I was always trying to do very innovative things with it. So I could reskin it a million times and make lots of money, but that doesn't really help me grow as a person, which is a personal thing that I need. But it doesn't really grow the technology. So I would be finding, I would always spin something like, okay, so Sprite, you want to do something? How about we do something where we do the soundtrack to a commercial, which eventually that turned into, you know, being put onto an NBA All-Star spot for with LeBron James. So it was like you keep selling those ideas, and even some of these things I didn't even know. Geez, I don't even know if we can build this stuff yet. I mean, I had ideas because I had an idea of where the technology was going from that sort of beta level thing. But it was always trying to push ahead and force yourself to create something. And I think a lot of the things that I've done have been a complete result of that. I mean, me writing some of the first books that I wrote was simply because no one's doing it. I've never done it, but like it needs to be done. Okay, let's do it. And I'll just force myself to learn. I'll sign up for it. Don't know how I'm going to do it. I'll get through it. And then before I'd ever spoken at a conference, I just saw someone do a really shitty talk on interactive music. And I said, that's it. Like, I'm going to do better. And we just put myself in situations that were uncomfortable. So I think it's always been pushing myself out of a comfort zone to grow and being self-aware enough to realize where my limits were. And signing up for something that was going to push me further, knowing that I'm going to meet new people, I'm going to learn new things, I'm going to expand whatever it is that I'm doing.
So as it was blowing up, did you make any mistakes?
I mean, nothing really monumental. I mean, later in life, through several businesses, certainly there were human-related things. Even with the company, I mean, as the opportunities came in, and, you know, maybe said yes to too many things, scaled up my agency very quickly to a point where I said, who are, like, you're not my friends. Like, it started off with just me and a couple of friends, the agency, and then I got to like 13 or 14, and I was like, I kind of don't like you. Like, you're a great illustrator, and you're in my spot all the time, but like, I don't like you, but I need you for this work, but. Yeah. And that's when I realized this it wasn't for me. And I just said, I'm going back to three people. Yeah. And it wasn't, I made more money with three people than it was 14. You're more lean, but it was, we enjoy each other's company. It was fun coming into work and just like, you'd want to do cool stuff because you're with your mates doing it. When it turned into more of a business and trying to satisfy other people's needs for a job and employment or some other client that wanted some cool thing that maybe wasn't as cool to me as it was to them, I found myself certainly, those would be the mistakes I said I may have made growing too fast as a result of thinking that you needed to, when realizing sometimes it's better to not do that.
What is Loop Labs now?
You know, it's closer to what I originally wanted to be because the success in doing a lot of, you know, multinational sort of campaigns for huge brands were always exciting because we would see there's millions of people making music. Fantastic. For me, it was just always frustrating because Q4, Q1 would come along and Bacardi would say, okay, that's great. And we're taking it down next week. I'm like, what? Like, why would you take it down? Like, why don't we just keep making it better? No, we're doing this next thing. Because a lot of companies don't put all their stock into one idea. They've already think in 18 months this is going to be a marketing thing. They're rolling along like that. So I feel it was frustrating for me to have this idea. If I think about this idea of this musical sort of community around the Grateful Dead and people just constantly just creating and connecting and collaborating together and having these things where it was doing that, but then it would be taken offline and then I would do the next one for Volvo or someone else and then all of a sudden those same people would find that was online from, you know, the cool side of the day or whatever it was back then. And I'd see these same people moving from one to another, but that wasn't what it was about. So ironically, it was Steve Jobs who kind of put the nail in the coffin for Flash, which was the underlying technology which all this was based on at the time. And that was when I kind of had to like take stock of things and say, this is not satisfying me. You know, great money, right? Like all that stuff. Business size, fantastic. Mm. But I'm not happy with the fact that it's not delivering on why I created this. And luckily, Google came along with, web audio, which was a new way to be able to facilitate that kind of audio capabilities, and sort of sat back and take stock to say, let's just keep this as our own thing and not focus on licensing it to other people. And you're just going to keep it, you're kind of your little baby, and you're going to grow this thing, and you're going to build community out of it, and you're going to have this thing stay there and let people create it. So, it's funny. It's in many ways, it's as much just this entity that I feel is, you know, my baby that I just want to keep going there. So I don't think of it as a business, but yet, you know, we've got 800, whatever, thousand people, you know, signed up, and hundreds of thousands of people every month, you know, making music and collaborating and changing a lot of people's lives. Like that's the greatest thing. I'll get stories from mothers of 7-year-olds saying, man, you know, my kid had some maybe attention deficit issues and they found your platform and they've now found music. And like, this is the most amazing thing. Like he's found peace. Or I'll speak to some woman, you know, almost 7 years old who like, it's her meditation. Like she's probably made like 400 tracks now on the platform. And she's just like, it's crazy. And those stories for me, like the human stories of the impact it has. Mm. And I think we're just touching on where I'd like to see some of this go, which is regards to the culture and the attention deficit, the sort of, just what's happening, particularly in the States. I mean, just with the pharmaceuticals that are being, you know, pumped into kids. Mm. A lot of kids are just really stressed out and being covered up with stuff. But music is this amazing thing, period, that has tremendous effects. I get these stories. So I think, it's kind of grown into this place.
Therapy.
Yeah. I mean, and to be honest, I mean, musical meditation to me is where I see a lot of potential in moving this because people need it. Mm-hmm. And you see the rise of wellness, of mental health, of meditation, all these things you see. You see all these calm and headspace. And these things 5 years ago, 10 years ago, people thought, oh man, meditation, what's wrong with you? Some, you know, joining a cult or something. Now it's commonplace, and you realize all the biggest people that are leading companies and the most impactful people are practicing this stuff. So I think there's a lot of power in that, and I'm really interested in exploring that from a scientific and sort of research background in terms of how music can affect people, because I think that's a huge opportunity for a platform like this ultimately.
So you've come through this like pioneering era. What is innovation in music look like now? Like, how do you see things where they're at? I mean, you're talking about where you want to take things, but more generally, what is, like, are people still innovating in music?
You know, listen, I spent a lot of time with the music industry. And, you know, I joke often about, you know, I think they're barely ahead of the Amish in terms of adopting new technology. And you've seen the demise of it. I mean, it's really been impacted, but they're really outside of streaming, and what Jobs did for music, where is the innovation? I mean, people will say all this VR stuff now, but truly there's really been no products or services. You know, what I worked many, many years for, and I mean, I still am, is the ability to look at music as something that should be thought of as more as software and open sourcing and crowdsourcing it. You know, the best example is if I'm an artist right now and I put out a single, I'm Drake, I put out a single, I'm making my money outside of my live shows. I'm making my money on Spotify. My streams are what pays me. Now, if we have a culture of open source and crowdsource, it would behoove an artist to be thinking, geez, imagine if I took my piece of music, I broke it up into its little parts. Here's my drum beat, my bass line, my vocals. I'm going to open source those pieces of music. I'm going to use my massive fan base with a tool like a Loop Labs that's, you know, democratizable and accessible to anyone on the planet, and say, how about you guys do something with this? Or I've only got my vocal. I haven't even done the music yet. You guys make it a trap song. Make it a house song. Make it a pop song. Make it a rock song. Do whatever the hell you want with it, but find a way to now monetize those things through a platform like a SoundCloud, which is now starting to monetize, or Spotify. Now one artist can make money not on one single piece of music as a track, maybe 1,000, 10,000, 1,000,000. That's a massive way to multiply your revenue as an artist. And I think trying to get that message into a traditional industry, which is still running, you know, definitely in the last century, has been super difficult for them to grasp the opportunity in that. I still hold on to that vision that that's where music will go. And I see Loop Labs and what we're doing being a part of that, because that is what it should be. Music should be free. But if you can find a way to monetize it, then that's a win for everyone.
It's crazy because like all the big hits now still seem to be underpinned by loops from all the massive hits of previous eras. You know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't feel like there's too much new out there.
Well, I mean, I think the future...
At least on a mainstream level anyway.
Well, no, I think the future for music outside of, you know, more traditional Ed Sheeran storytelling, things people connect to on a human level, it's about the sonics. Like certainly the advancements in music and from a hardware or software perspective to create music, there's new sounds that have never been heard before. So a lot of it is with that new sound, which is why a platform like Loop Labs, like we've got sounds where you can take crazy like raga Indian sounds with like trap sounds. And it's like the mixture of those things you're starting to see in the last few years. Whereas it's funny because as long as Loop Labs has been running, we always listen to the tracks and it's like it's so eclectic because these kids don't know. They're not trying to be a hip hop producer or whatever. Mm. They're just like all these sounds magically all go together in the same tempo and the same key. I'll just pull these different things together. Mm. So it's always this weird combination of sounds, which makes it really unique. Mm. So I think the innovation's been focused on kind of more the sound of stuff. But the one thing that I think that you mentioned, which I think a lot about, is the culture has moved to loop, short form loops. And I've been watching it the whole time going, right, whether it was Vine, Instagram, whether it's music production, it's more and more it's a song repeated for 3 minutes with a short clip. It's like, so in many ways that idea of building things around that is kind of prescient in terms of what people are doing now. That's how people are consuming content. Everything is looping now. So in many ways, you know, we're sitting in a really nice spot to be able to leverage that. So I think culture has come to that point where it is like that. But also, you think about how much video is being created online. Like, It's the biggest, fastest growing, you know, delivery mechanism of media ever in the future, in history. But getting music is super difficult for people. Even if you wanted to put a bumper on this podcast, you gotta be like, okay, what am I gonna do? Am I gonna go to some cheesy stock music place and get stuff that you kind of hear on all the other YouTube, you know, videos? Are you gonna make your own? Cause it's so funny cause people can make, they can put up their own web shops, they can create their own videos, they can create their own pictures, they can 3D, all these things you can do, but you say, hey, can you make music? If you weren't trained, you just think, no, I can't. It's so interesting to me that white space is music production. But music is a big part of all this video. You need to have backing music. So, I mean, that's to me, again, one of those huge, huge white spaces of being able to, and we see a lot of people that are creating video games, people that are video editors, people are coming to our platform to be able to create music, because in 5-10 minutes they can easily create something on their own, which is custom like no one else's, that they can drop on to their own piece of content. So I think helping fill that box of music creation and the bigger tool set of creation for media in general is where I see the innovation going, and certainly one of the directions I think, you know, we're focused on, you know, fulfilling.
So how on earth did you end up in Adelaide?
Yeah, that's a question you get asked a bit, right? When you talk funny here. You know, listen, it was as a result of doing a lot of these really interesting projects in the early 2000s. I was just very fortunate to be, you know, speaking internationally and asked to speak at a lot of conferences or doing tours with Adobe or whoever. And just really was doing a conference called OFF, an amazing conference in Barcelona. That year they held it in Valencia, Spain, and I was there. And just happened to, you know, my story is very different than my partner's, but, you know, just locked eyes across this crazy, you know, first time in Spain, this open air monastery, just lock eyes with this girl who turns out to be a girl from Glen Elg studying in Valencia, Spain. And, but you know, what's interesting about that story really is that I guess learning to just follow your instinct on things, and my instinct was so like this person. Or definitely before she thought that. But, you know, I literally left my agency. I sold my car. I left everything, probably with spending less than 2 weeks of time with this person. I said, right, I'm going to Barcelona. I don't know this person. I've never lived with a girl before. I've got a company. I got all these things. Didn't speak Spanish. And everyone was like, yo, dude, like, what are you doing? I was like, you have to do it. Like, how, I have to do this.
What's she thinking at the time? You said that she took a while to come around.
Well, I mean,
this bloke's selling up everything to chase her.
I like to think, you know, the time spent, I think we both realized that it was probably worth exploring. I mean, I certainly knew, for me, it was like this weird instant thing, because I saw her the next day and I was like, oh my God, I saw her again. You know, she didn't remember that first eye crossing. I do. So I'm the one who always gets to tell that story when people ask how'd you meet.
Given your musical background and your looping music, you would have, as you talked to her, you set some like romantic, like theme music behind as you kind of, maybe not.
I wish I could be that meditative. but one of the big lessons, you know, I think personally from that was, you know, here I kind of like, people thought I was just risking everything, but the next 3 years, you know, spending a lot of time in Spain, they were by far the most productive, the most creative, the most financially rewarding of any part of my life, almost pretty much to date. And I think a lot of it has to do when you just know something is there and you follow it. I feel like that was the universe saying, good for you, man. Like that was something good for you for following on that. And like, look how things are just easier. Like it was almost like years of effortless, like, opportunity were there, and I was open to it, and it was an amazing time. But certainly, as you get older and you settle down a little bit, and you want to have kids, you know, we'd moved to New York, and two little kids in Manhattan is, you know, from a guy growing up in the streets, similar to, you know, here in South Australia, just wasn't the right place. And certainly the country with, you know, Trump coming in, it just felt like it was burning. And we left. And we left, and you know, her family's here in Glen Elg, and we wanted to bring the kids to see them. And she, you know, she'd been living in, man, like, you know, Japan before Spain. So she had not spent a lot of time with her family, and I think she wanted to do that. And ended up here. And it may be me that keeps us here, because I just got just enthralled with what was happening here, man. Like, I got here right sort of after sort of the Elon Musk announcement and the Astronautical Congress and the whole space stuff. And I had some friends in Singularity University, and I was hearing about all these things. And I guess as a guy that, you know, couldn't drink more than a couple, you know, Coopers in the backyard with wondering what happens here, just started to get out really, really quickly. And I've learned since then, a lot of people don't have that same wherewithal to go out and meet people the way that I was, with that New York energy in me. And just by meeting so many people and hearing the stories and all these things that were happening, I thought, man, this kind of reminds me of like what Austin, you know, sister city, ironically, felt like in the late 90s. Like it had this similar like energy and kind of thing, like things could be popping off. And just really thought, maybe you should stay around for a year or two and see if I can't help out in some way, participate, watch this thing grow, just see if we can make something happen here, because it would be amazing to be sort of more on the ground floor of like a real ascension for a city like Adelaide.
People may be surprised that given your background, where you've lived, that Adelaide has hooked you.
Yeah, you know, it's, I mean, listen, I think there's a lot of things that are here that I feel a lot of people, maybe just because it's just here, you don't see it when you're not outside of it, right? The standard of life here, the quality of life, just the amazing area of the world here, from so many parts. It's special. I mean, it's funny because, you know, as a guy in Toronto and Natalie from Adelaide, it was always like in the top five. It was always Toronto, Adelaide, these cities. We'd always be like, ah, this year you got me. Or like, we were always, but I'd still have to hear the stories of like, oh, where's Adelaide? Oh, it's, you know, near Melbourne. Like, it was always weird to think, like, here's a city that's on par with Toronto for the best places to live in the world that we'd always be watching, but yet kind of no one knew about it. So I think a lot of people don't see the opportunity that is here or see how amazing things are, because it's easy to be complacent here. I don't blame or fault anyone for that, because, yeah, like, things are great. Like, why should I hustle? Like, a lot of people, like, I get why they wouldn't, because it's just like things are like how you'd kind of want it to be. Not to say there's not a lot of things that should happen, that are happening, that could happen, but I think it was more my identifying the opportunity that I felt like things were just lining up. Like the city is future-proofing itself. You've got this real big push to space, which I see as a gigantic industry full of a lot of opportunity with spiraling, machine learning, or IoT, all the things that will spin off that new data set. That data is so valuable. And everything's kind of positioned to be in a really good place. And I thought, if I could be a part of any of this, and I was joking around, right? I was totally joking around with my friends when I first got here. Oh, maybe I'll like be helping like some nanobot space company, like not even know what I was talking about. And sure enough, like, I've had the opportunity to not only meet, but become friends with a lot of people that are in sort of the space industry. I've actively been helping some of these companies with marketing and doing stuff because that's one of the things I have identified is the marketing. And we talked about this earlier. There's not a lot of that here. The storytelling, the narrative about what people are doing is confusing for a lot of people. Like, I think a lot of people don't even know how to describe what is South Australia to other people. That's not a consistent message. So I guess what's keeping me here more than anything else is beyond a beautiful place to have a family and kids grow up with, just a piece of heaven here, is just helping shape or be a part of in some small way what is happening here.
Mm. So around this time last year, South Start, which is Adelaide's startup conference, after the event, the guys decide to wind it up, finish up, and we're all thinking, okay, well, that's game over for South Start. How on earth did you become a part of the group that would resurrect it and take it into a new direction?
Well, maybe I'll think it's part of that universe again, conspiring to sort of put those pieces together. But again, I've never had the fortunate, you know, opportunity to ever go to a previous South Start. So all I know is what people say, and certainly there's a lot of passion about a get-together like that. I mean, it's needed. But I think as a part of me reaching out to try to find as many amazing people doing stuff here, I was just very lucky or fortunate or whatever to find people like a Joe Thorpe doing his stuff at Tech NSA and just totally clicking with him and what he was doing. And certainly Jason at Moonshine, like, here's a guy, like, yeah, he's got like agency stuff. He's got this crazy punk club thing, which, you know, we should get to because people will wager what they won't bet on startups, but that's another thing. and, you know, doing the startup grinds and he was like into the events and like, I was like, ah, this is good because I definitely saw from an outsider's perspective again, tons of passion, tons of fragmentation and, living in very dense places like Barcelona and New York, there's just so much collisions and creative sort of cross-pollination that happens, which is a part of how you build an ecosystem. You need to have people that are business hanging out with propeller heads, and you need to have all these disparate artists and creatives and technologists together to have new ways of looking at things, to create product or to grow product or to get input. And I just didn't see a lot of that. Like, I'm a big supper party guy. I love bringing together interesting people and sharing ideas. And I didn't see as much of that as I thought I could. People wanted it, and they were doing it passionately in different places. And then, sure enough, coming in as an entrepreneur in residence with actually both Tech NSA and with Jason at the Moonshine, the news of, I guess, it going away and potentially being there, Jason acknowledged, like, for sure, we have to have an event like this. This is crazy. This is the event. We can't let it go away. And, you know, he put his hand up saying, like, all right, like, me, Moonshine, like, we're going to take it on. Around the time that I came in, and I had experience, you know, helping start and launch Canada's largest design and technology conference. I love conferences in general. It was kind of like, you want to like run this thing? And I'm like, oh shit, yeah, like this is amazing. It's exactly what I want to do, what I love, and I think what is really useful here. So I think it's just a timing thing. You know, I think it just, yeah, I don't know what it is. It's the right people, the right time, whatever it is, and it's like, here's the reins to this thing, and certainly some mixed feelings, I think, about it, but from maybe the community, but exciting. It's so exciting.
It's not easy to take on a conference, though. It's a lot involved. Like, how have you, as an outsider coming in, trying to put on an event, like, to be honest, I think there's a bit of baggage with the Adelaide startup community. There was a few people doing a lot of work. It got burnt out. As an outsider coming in, how have you negotiated all of that stuff and to try and spread the message that you're bringing in energy and that you're bringing in something new?
Well, I guess I'm not trying to spread any message necessarily about something new. I think I made a point of, and I had the luxury of the time because people like to do coffees here, of, you know, meeting a lot of people and listening. And very quickly, I got a real sense of what was missing. I mean, it became very evident there's a real problem with, you know, getting early stage capital. There's certainly a lot of people that are doing duplication of efforts. There's just a lot of things that I realized that I thought could be somewhat addressed. But I think also, again, I had no idea what it was before, but the one thing I do see here is that this is not Melbourne, this is not Sydney, it's very different. And to try to have a startup conference from my perspective that's all about, hey, we're going to bring in like growth and it's about how to scale up your, you know, your photo sharing app. Like, no, I mean, that doesn't really happen here. I mean, yes, you have the biggest fitness app in the world here, which very few people, you know, acknowledge to the extent I think you should. But I think focusing it on the strengths and capabilities is something you have to do here. Not only for the community here to know that, yes, this is the stuff we're interested in, and you're going to have, whether it's ag tech or IoT, smart cities, space, artificial intelligence, machine learning, these are the things that are largely here. And that's logical. Like, you have defense. There's a lot of defense money here that drives a lot of deeper technology. There's serious research here. But if we also play to those strengths, you're offering a unique environment that you're not going to see in the rest of the states. And you need to do that if you want to invite other people here. Mm. And I've come here as a guest and seen this place is amazing. If we can do a good job of hosting the same way that, you know, the Fringe and the festival thing brings people in around entrepreneurial thinking and technologies here, that's good for the state. Because I think part of me thinks, like, I would love nothing more than to have, you know, everyone partying out on Peel Street and like this amazing energy and having, you know, some guy from Sydney say to some guy here from Adelaide, man, this place is amazing. Mm. You guys are awesome. And have someone just lift up their backs and then go, yeah, it is amazing. It's amazing. Because a lot of people don't not acknowledge it. And whether it takes someone not from here where you think you need to be telling you it actually is good, if that helps, I don't know. But it's certainly something that should be showcased. And I think anything that can be done to do that is only going to be beneficial to all aspects of this.
So how do you distill that down and articulate your vision about what this conference is going to be all about?
I mean, certainly, you know, it's, you know, I like to sort of frame it as, you know, celebrating that collision that you bring in people, ideas, and technology together, and you do it in a way that allows them to properly connect, to properly form relationships. That's key. I mean, a lot of people ask me, well, what's a win here? And for me, it's kind of really simple. It's like, get everyone that doesn't normally get together, have a great time, be inspired, talk, have some wine, eat together, and go, wow, like, didn't know all this stuff was happening, didn't know you before, and get a lot of young people there and put on a platform and a stage where they can walk away and think, you know, I read all this stuff about the brain drain and all this stuff, and that's what I read, but I see, like, there is investment here. There's an amazing community here. There's these cool mentors, companies, businesses that don't get enough awareness. There's just amazing stuff happening. I think it's important to put this stuff on display. And I get it, right? Like, there's this tall poppy thing and there's this imposter syndrome thing. And it's real. Like, I've come to realize it's a real thing. But if we can start thinking of just raising all poppies so no one's taller and be proud about it and celebrate failure and success, because there's a lot of mindset things that have to happen. So I think it's just trying to culture an environment where maybe people feel, I don't like talking about safe spaces, but a place where, like, you're amongst peers. Like, I often joke with a lot of people about, there's no Startups Anonymous here. There's no real place to go and just vent it. Like, I keep that story. Like, yeah, you know, my partner just wish I would just pack this in. Like, it's not working. The other guy goes, yeah, me too. Like, God, I think I'm going to get a divorce over it. Having them come together and be able to have a beer and just, like, do that, like, that's important. And you need to have more outlets of connecting with people that are trying to do stuff, because it's not easy. This stuff is really hard. Mental health, this is a thing that's going to come around the corner really soon here. It's a nascent startup community compared to what's happening in other parts of the world. We should look at it as an opportunity, but at the same time prepare ourselves for how to build and take those learnings to have a strong foundation to support if the space industry really starts bubbling here. We need to support that.
Which speakers are you most excited about?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I don't know when this will come out, so I don't know if it's been announced, but there's a company called Soul Machines, based out of New Zealand, that I think is just doing some of the most, like, just insane, incredible things. They have this thing called Baby X, and basically modeled a virtual human, but putting a face to it, having sort of a neurological, biological, intelligence built into it. So it's learning to react to people, learning to paint and draw and make music and do things and respond to tone and looking at it from a very human perspective. Mm. I mean, it's somewhat creepy. I mean, you know, in some ways to some people, but it's also the fast coming future. Like you think about all this stuff, like, you know, fake news is one thing, but deep fakes is another thing. And we're at the point now where, yeah, I can make you look and say anything I want. And that's going to be in the hands of everyone in a couple of years. Everyone. Everyone. Mm. So that's a crazy world. These people are totally like ahead of anyone else that I've seen in the world doing that. So I'm really excited to bring that here. I'm really excited. Like, I mean, I guess some of the curation has been selfish about just some of the amazing things that I've seen in Australia, wanting to showcase. But that certainly would be one of them. I mean, it's so hard. It would be unfair for me to try to think about it. I mean, I think what's going to be the most interesting for me is the conversations between some of these people and just generally the people at the event. Mm. To me, the conversations that hopefully this will inspire, the questions that will be sort of pondered as a result of some of these things that are put forth at the conference, to me, the conversations around that is probably what I'm most interested in. So there's some people I'm hoping they're going to provoke people and present things. I mean, we got quantum computing here. Mm. Like that's something that a lot of people aren't familiar with, but like it's just one of those things where it's like the future's coming. And if we start thinking about these things now and young people think about it, we're better positioned to figure out if we think we know where the future's going. That gives me a really good idea of some of the things maybe I want to build or where I want to be when it gets there. And if we don't really think about where the future's going, we look too much to the past or the now, it's like this place could be a ghost town as easy as it could be the next hotspot in the world. I mean, that's the reality with an aging population and distribution of a city like this. That's, you know, the fact that there's so many administrative jobs here and some of the best AI in the world, well, that AI is going to displace the majority of the job type of jobs that are here. Like, it's the irony is not lost on me. Like, so conversations about that are important. But yeah, I definitely no favorites, but yeah, a little bit like Soul Machine is one of those ones I really wanted to have here. I'm happy to have them a part of it.
So if listeners want to get around South Start, how do they go about it? How do they go about tickets? How do they go about getting involved in other ways? What do you want people to do to perhaps plug in and activate with this community?
Well, come, right? I mean, we're doing everything we can to put on an amazing couple of days to connect with people. And it's as much about, you know, if you're an academic interested or developing or researching things in these areas, come and meet people that are doing it as startups. Come meet corporates that are already building companies on these technologies. Like, it's that cross-pollination. Like, just come and do it. Cause like I've learned, right? Like, people in Adelaide like to buy the tickets like 2 days before. And I like to keep saying it's called the Eventbrite curve. I call it like, you know, that's the hockey stick thing.
It's just not fun for an event organizer, is it?
Ah, listen, I can understand why it would be very, very frustrating for a lot of people. I've talked to a lot of people that put on events that need to happen here, and like I've had conversations with them, like even the blockchain event that that Flinders helped put together. Like, I remember like just conversation about like, oh, I don't know, should we just pull the plug on this thing? Like, there's no sales. Like, and some people might have pulled the plug. Then all of a sudden, like a couple days before, it's like, oh my god, we get like we're at capacity. It's like we get like oversubscribed. It's like, That's problematic, right? I mean, so I can see why a lot of people get put off by doing it, because it can be a lot of stress. For whatever reasons, I've just like said, like, I just don't care about that. Mm. This event's going to be amazing. It's going to do all the things that it can do, that it should do, that to try to bring people together. If you don't come, you don't come, but it would be a loss. So for me, it's just, I just want everyone to be there. Come out from your hiding, come out from your little rock in the hills, wherever you are doing cool stuff, get down here, because everyone needs to look around and go, oh Jesus, look at us all. Like, we all care. We're all doing this stuff. Like, let's have a party. Let's talk. Let's make businesses. Let's find partnerships. Like, this is the opportunity to start that. And by no way is this some magic elixir where, like, you know, this event's going to just change things. But hopefully it's one step to get people more and more doing this. Maybe next year they'll buy tickets earlier. And I mean, that's the irony, right? If you sold out all your tickets early, there's even more we could do. Mm. We could commit to more things. So that would be the most frustrating part. Like, this could even be bigger and better. A lot of ideas we can't do. But I think it's just showing up. If you care about startups, if you care about these technologies, if you're interested in innovation, where the future's going, whether you're a consultant at a Big Four, whether you're running a company that's in defense or in space, whether you're a young person doesn't know what the future is, we're trying to put as much on display. Just come and experience it and get to know people. Like, that's how these things start, people.
Awesome. Well, mate, I've loved having a chat about your story and the fascinating journey you've been on, and thanks for sharing about Southstart as well. I mean, it's interesting times around the world, but particularly for Adelaide. So thanks as a outsider coming in, mate. Thanks for getting around us and putting your skin in the game. That's a big thing.
And listen, thank you for having me think about, you know, being given pile drivers as a kid.
Sorry for picking at that scab.
No, it's all part of it. No, this has been fantastic. I mean, I love doing this. These conversations I thrive on, and I look forward to the next series of stuff that you do, because more of these conversations should happen. So, like, yeah, get in touch with this guy. Ronnie knows what he's doing. Like, let's get the conversation going.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed our chat with Craig Swan. Now, if you haven't already, make sure you get involved with Southstart. Open your browser and visit southstart.co. Buy your tickets and support Adelaide's exciting startup community. Connect with Rooster Radio and listen to more than 100 interviews with interesting people doing amazing things at roosterradio.biz. And if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast player. Thanks for listening.